Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And it's just the two of us today. We don't have Tosin. Tosin's on his way to PAX, so he's going to give us a big update on what that was like next week. And we don't have Chris Bernauer this week either. But this week, Dropbox acquires superstar app Mailbox. Google shuts down Reader and the internet goes berserk. Netflix goes social. Samsung launches the S4, the Galaxy S4. And Apple goes on the defensive. And Veronica Mars is back on Kickstarter. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. So, Duane, what has obsessed you over the last week?
Oh, man, it's been kind of mundane, but kind of exciting. I've been really, like, re-exploring human interface devices. I had, and by that I just mean keyboards, mice, trackpads, and things like that. Basically, I had a Logitech Denovo Media Desktop from 2002 or 2003, and it just died after 10 years. So I had to go out and find a new keyboard.
Like a computer keyboard.
Yes, exactly.
You put keyboards in the rundown. I assumed that you were talking about a musical keyboard.
No. I just mean literally what you type on. Uh-huh. And for me, I know for many people, it's really intimate. You'll hear people be like, oh, I like the old clickety-clackety ones and everything. But for me, the Logitech Denovo desktop was, it's really quiet. It's got this kind of old school laptop keyboard feel. It's got the crazy media buttons, only four or five. It's got four or five media buttons that are kind of offset on the side. Mm-hmm. And the number pad was a separate device. It had a screen on it. And when you got email from Outlook, the email would show up on that screen. So you didn't have to be by your computer. And in an age before mobile devices, that was kind of cool. You'd be like, oh, that email just came in from my boss. I better go back to the computer and do whatever. It's a Saturday or something. It also allowed you to – you could use it as a remote control for any computer connected to a television set or whatever. So I'd have Media Player Classic, and I hit the play button, and it would play whatever show was in the queue. So, I mean, it was just a good all-around thing for its era, back in – the early 2000s, but that time has passed. So while I found a couple of them on eBay, and I did buy one just as a backup, I looked out for new stuff. And of course, I went to Logitech because they're my favorite company when it comes to this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of the chiclet feeling, but right. I ended up getting three or four Logitech boards, and I sent the other ones back. I stayed with the Logitech. It's like the K750. It is the solar Apple keyboard. And I use it on a Windows machine. and what it does is it's a keyboard. It's flat. It's really neat. It's got, all the trappings of a modern keyboard. It actually looks a lot like the Apple wide keyboard, the big one with the USB cable. But it's wireless. It uses the unifying receiver that we all know and love. So that's like six devices on one little thing that goes into one USB port. And what it does is it doesn't need any batteries ever. It just uses light from your light fixture or from the window or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just like one of those calculators from back in 1995, it uses the solar power in order to power itself. So that's it. It's pretty brilliant. It's pretty clever. It doesn't actually, its feedback is great. Its response time is great. I don't feel any hiccups. I never have to charge a battery because I hate when I'm typing my password and one of the keys gets stuck and you see a row of black dots. But I'm using it on my work computer. And the reason why I got the Windows one instead of the other one was because I like having a quote-unquote Windows key on either side of the keyboard.
Sure.
And because it's a bigger keyboard, the Windows version has the Windows key on the left side but a function button on the right side. And so I don't – when I want to lock my computer, yeah. I've got to hit the thumb on my left and get it all the way over to the L. So I get the Mac one because – literally, I want to, the command key is on both sides and it becomes the Windows key.
Uh-huh.
Yada, yada, yada. So that's the story. It's a great one. So I'm pretty excited about it. But, it's kind of mundane and awful. But at the same time, if you're going to replace your keyboard every 10 years, everything I've read about this one is that it's pretty tight. It's got all these reviews on Amazon and a couple other places. And on top of all that, it's sturdy as fuck. So
it says actual solar powered.
It's got solar panels across its top.
Wow, I've never heard of a solar powered keyboard.
They have three of them. They have the Windows version, the Apple version, and they have a mini version.
That's insane. I'm definitely going to check that out.
I mean, and they also have a Marathon mouse, which is a mouse that has the batteries in series instead of in parallel instead of series. So it doesn't use one battery until the first battery is finished. They claim 3 years of life. I've used one for about, I don't know, a year. I haven't actually had to change the batteries yet. So, you know, they've got some thinking going on there at Logitech. And, you know, for that, I'm happy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Yeah, it looks – it's definitely cool. I see the different – the mini and then the other two solar keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Clearly derived off of the Apple design. But it's funny because the Windows one does look pretty different from the Apple one in terms of the type of design they were looking for.
They went black.
They went black and it kind of – exactly. The keys feel different. They're not matte. They're shiny. They're more slippery. It's a whole new thing. So anyhow – just wanted to – I don't know why I went off on keyboards. I'm sorry, people. You must be so bored.
What else have you been playing with? I bet you it's something that I've been playing with too.
I think it is. You know, a lot of us have been waiting in line to get the Mailbox app. I finally got it on my iPhone. And, you know, I hooked it up. A little disappointed that all it does is Google, but I can see why because that's like the most open API right now.
Sure.
And, you know, I got to say, the speed of delivery, the lack of clutter and clunkiness – the way it works is pretty smooth. The only problem for me is that because there's no similar client on the desktop, and because there's no way to manage folders, unless you experience mail only through the mail app, life gets pretty confusing pretty fast. That's my only caveat. Everything else I like, it's smooth, it's fast. Oftentimes I'll get a message on my lock screen on my phone, I'll open it up, the app will open up, and I'll wait. That doesn't, you know, oh, wait, like, oh, I'm going to actually get the message. So I just got the header. Now I have to get the whole message. It's not happening here. It opens up damn quick. So I don't know. I just feel like it's a great app. But at the same time, because it's so focused on this swipe, this swipe functionality where you don't actually have to, you know, it's not a question of reading it right then, but they treat the mail as a whole bunch of tasks or action items.
Right.
So you swipe to the left to do one thing. You swipe to the right to do another thing. I'll read it later. I'll handle it here. This is already done. That's kind of their focus. And because of that, they don't want you to really have to worry about managing folders or labels. And that is a bit difficult if you're using Google for work, unless you have a series of filters set up that's going to predefine everything. It really becomes a little different from you know, there's a learning curve.
Did you find that it makes you more efficient about your mail, about getting through your mail?
I do. But I also find that the Apple Mail all inbox situation has also been pretty helpful. My only problem with that situation is that the up or down button that I use to read through mail, like, you know, scroll from one message to the other, it's in a place that my thumb doesn't readily get to. So that's all right, and I've gotten used to that, and that's part of the problem. I've gotten used to some other things. If Mailbox had come out before Gmail revamped its Google revamped its Gmail app, then I think we'd all be using Mailbox, and Gmail's app would not have many users. But the problem is they came out before, and having come out before, people have begun getting used to the Gmail app, which is much better than it used to be, but still has some things to fix. I think Mailbox is pretty exciting. I think it's an interesting way to like organize your stuff. Yeah. I do like the very idea that you don't need to have folders in order to get through things. That is really cool in a abstract kind of way. I just don't know if the average user is going to find that valuable given the paradigm that we've come to know when it comes to dealing with mail. But how do you use it?
Well, I found that it's like to me it does sort of speed up my my mail sorting experience. Like I when I first got it, immediately I had literally thousands of email messages that I had not sorted in one form or another or thrown away, and immediately it archived all of them, which I was a little, you know, I was a little trepidatious about because it's like, it's all gone. Where'd it go? But then after I breathed a little bit and calmed down, I'm like, okay, if I didn't focus, if I didn't attend to those in any sort of timely fashion that I didn't really need to see those again. And they're always there. I can always access them through search or whatever. And so once my inbox was at zero, stuff started coming in, it became easier for me to just sort of swipe things away to archive or sort things for later. I find it does help. It's not the second coming, as I think, who was it that had it last week? Was it Chris or Tosin? I think it was
Chris. Chris? Yeah, the second coming.
It's not the second coming, but it does. I think it's, for me, it's more efficient to open that up and sort through my mail than it is to go through the Google's own or Apple's own app interface.
Yeah. So here's the thing for me that's interesting. If I was able to really deliver on answering mail that I get through Gmail or Google Apps or whatever, if I was able to answer that mail in a powerful, effective, and professional way via the mailbox app, I'm talking bullet points and like numbered lists and paragraphs, where I'm able to go over it and I'm looking up something on the web and then I go back in an easy way, then mailbox really would be the be-all and end-all email. The problem is I can't do that. So if I get a business email, I can't exactly just throw it away on mailbox, Yeah. I have to have it sit there and I have to kind of go to the next one.
Yeah.
So that's the problem. Like the mobile devices are obviously awesome, but I really don't have the power that I have when I'm using a really boring application like Outlook,
Right. But once again, I think it would be like this app would be a lot more efficient once other email clients are able to be integrated into the service. With the Gmail, it's a little limited right now. So let's get into some headlines here. Speaking of mailbox, Dropbox is buying the owner of the Buzzy Mailbox app, making its first move into products outside its core file sharing service. Under the deal, the 13 employees of Mailbox will join Dropbox. Dropbox will keep the Mailbox service running as a standalone app, and over time, Dropbox will also use the Mailbox technology to enhance Dropbox's features like email attachment. TechCrunch reports that they feel that the move has two layers of significance for the company, and it points to what more we'll see in its future. First, it's a sign of an even bigger push into mobile for Dropbox. In addition to Mailbox, Dropbox has made a few other acquisitions that point specifically to cloud services that work on mobile devices. Dropbox clearly sees mobile as an essential route ahead for the company. And secondly, it's a sign of how Dropbox wants to be more than just a cloud storage company. Storage is the thing that people pay for now, but down the line, there may be that eventually Dropbox will want to make money from other revenue streams to diversify its business.
But let's also think about it like the way the cable company has dealt with it, right? Cable, your bandwidth, that's a utility. And Dropbox is very much a utility. They forced themselves into that position when they began giving away 2 gigabytes free to anyone, up to 16 gigabytes free from having 32 of your friends join under your link.
Yeah.
So they're a utility. And if they don't find a way to have a more relevant interaction with the consumer than just being a place where other APIs drop the stuff, then they're going to be usurped by someone eventually. They could be a staple, but they won't be able to get that face time with the consumer that can really drive and market, drive them up, and allow them to market new services and products. Mailbox allows them to do that. Dropbox is now in your face.
Yeah.
And, you look at a company like Tosin's Box and, Dropbox looks at that and they say, okay, we got the consumer. Those guys have the enterprise. But we all know that there is a merge, especially in the connected world we live in. There's a growing type of user who's not the super users that you and I and Devendra and like Chris and Tosin are, that just wants to have one computer where they can get everything. And given that Box came out giving away 50 gigabytes and other things like that, people will eventually begin to move there. If Dropbox isn't meeting their needs. So by tying in Mailbox,
sure,
you begin to show that I am a cloud company. I'm about your mail and your mobile. I'm about your storage wherever you are. This is what I am. I'm not just a utility. Or if I am a utility, because mail could be seen as a utility as well. If I am a utility, then I'm a utility that's completely innovative. We all know the story that Steve Jobs met with the Dropbox guys, and they explained what they were, and he kind of nodded and said, okay, so what's the big deal? A couple years later, we're like, how can you live without Dropbox? I see the icon on everybody's computer at work, and we don't really use it at work anyway. I see the icon on, my mom's computer, and she is just one of those people who's not hardcore about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I'm saying. So they've gained a level of relevance, and I think especially because of the way that Mailbox has been rolled out in a brilliant manner, whereupon people had to wait.
Right, there was that buzz.
The buzz was built with numbers. It was data. This is how many people are in front of you. This is how many people are behind you. Yeah. There's a status built into that.
Absolutely.
I'm number whatever to get Dropbox. Mailbox. I'm number whatever to in line. And I can't wait because I can see the number ticking down. And I really want that. And that marketing, even though it's not quite like – it's not exactly – a marketing plan. It's just like, sure. Hey, you got to wait in order for us to implement this correctly.
But they kind of pioneered that by doing that. I mean, I hadn't seen any other companies sort of doing that line waiting thing.
It's both viral because you want to share, right? Yeah. In fact, they would have been good to put a little Facebook like or Twitter like share your place in line thing or whatever because people would have done that. It's both viral. It's viral, but it's also it's magnetic. People want to know where they stand, and that let you know where you stood. And it also managed expectations. I'm not going to get into some system where I'm going to break. They're using probably like an Amazon cloud service or some other thing, and they're spinning up processing and storage and all those things as quickly as they can. And that's what that number in part reflected. So that when you got to the service, it was as good for you, number 500,000, as it was for the person who got it first.
Right.
And that's really what... that's really what a company that's trying to scale quickly needs to think about. So I call it marketing, even though I'm sure it wasn't exactly some marketing director's plan in there.
It's a happy but accident almost.
It's a sign that, the best way to represent yourself is completely truthfully. Mm-hmm. We have limitations, and we're going to make you be a part of those limitations in a fun way. So yeah, Mailbox and Dropbox and the names. You talk about real marketing.
Sure.
The names are perfect, right?
Yes. Yes. Mailbox, Dropbox. What does this mean for a competitor box?
There's going to be a trademark fight maybe in a little while.
Maybe down the line.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's move on here. Facebook users are now able to share information about the videos they watch with friends with the launch of a new service Netflix calls Netflix Social. The feature is similar to an integration Facebook launched for services such as Spotify that enables Facebook users to share what they're listening to with friends within the service. Facebook and Netflix announced that they'd partner with sharing features back in September 2011, but they were unable to implement it in the
U.S. Because of the law.
Because of a video privacy law that prevented stores from publishing customers' rental histories. Netflix lobbied successfully to change that act to allow... sharing on social networks, and President Obama signed those changes in the law in January. So here's...
Wow, so we can't get a budget, but we can get some Netflix sharing. Okay, all right.
Priorities. So here's how...
I'm just kidding, but this is I just want to get into this law a little bit. This law was designed back when, we all think about technology and culture. That's kind of what, Subedak was about. That's definitely what a lot of the drill down is about. Mark Zuckerberg says things like the default is social. People freak out because they're like, no, wait, it's not. I want privacy. There was a time when video cassettes, VHS cassettes were new, and the video store rental places that sold them were new. And there were all these things about, well, what if I just went into a place and someone found out that I saw some movie that was rated R, or, God forbid, rated X. And they saw that. And I was denied jobs, or I was a scandal in my community, or whatever. If you're a video store owner, making sure that information was kept sacrosanct, was kept, private, really private, really helped you with your ability to get new users, right? So it didn't matter whether it was rated X or if it was rated PG-13. But the fact is, walking into a store that you could not, no one could pull out your history. Your history was private. And that's where that law came from.
But it didn't. It didn't reflect the changes in the changes in technology. The changes.
Well, that's the issue. The thing is, when a law is the problem with the law, sometimes that when it's made, it's usually made to stick around.
Right.
And it's not necessarily left out to revisit. So Facebook and Netflix were like, "Yeah, let's get this done. Let's do this stuff. Yeah, And then they were confronted with the fact that we're a country of law. Our rule is law. It's not common sense. It's just law. Sometimes law isn't common sense. Hopefully it is. It's why we like elect people. And that's kind of where that stood. So they've been working for, you know, almost a year and a half, a little, you know, since late 2011, to get this stuff turned over. And this also represents a big change in the way the technology industry lobbies. Because we've all been there with SOPA and PIP and all these things.
Sure.
Like, how come Google's not down there with some big K Street firm making sure that our rights are protected, or at least making sure that, you know, the internet will work, even though we hate them because of privacy? The fact is, Netflix lobbied successfully for this. And it's such an overwhelmingly popular service. And people do want to share what they're watching.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a very, I don't know, it's a very good thing.
They
it's
used to have a social
component.
Yeah, yeah. Years ago, yeah.
That was inside Netflix, and I think one of the reasons, and this is speculation, but it seemed to me that one of the reasons why that had to go away was because at a time when content owners began really charging Netflix for pricing, and Netflix wasn't sure how that was going to work, the idea of the efficiency of all these users watching the, you know, this one show that they only had X amount of licenses to show out, that could have gotten in the way. But I actually think that part of it was still this law, this idea that on the same network, Netflix in this case, you can't really, like, no third party can show what two different people are looking at. Now, basically, we've got the situation where you're going to have to opt in. You say you want to share, it's going to do exactly what every other Facebook app does.
Yep.
Hey, do you want to give this thing permission? You're going to say that, and that's why
you're going to be able to see what your friends have watched, and friends will be able to see what what videos you've watched on Facebook. You can choose individual videos that you don't want to share with your larger network, just in case you know.
And this goes back to the whole thing with Last.fm had their Scrobbler on iTunes. It's still out there.
Sure.
And this kind of thing, this ties into this idea of the quantified self. The ability to say, "I saw that already. I saw that when and then, and it was good." And I listened to it or whatever. And, you know, maybe the pattern that develops will allow you to do things like what Flixster used to do on Facebook, where you can see who a good movie buddy would be for you.
Yeah.
Because you like so many of the same movies. That kind of thing. So, I mean, I'm excited about this functionality, even though it's like the technology's been there for a while. But now that we can actually do it because of the barriers have been taken away, I'm excited for what's possible. Not unlike, you know, what happens when we get to the moon. We can do the moon right now. There are all these barriers in the way.
Right, right. So speaking of online movie streaming, Redbox Instant by Verizon officially launched to the public last Thursday. Launch comes after a three-month-long closed beta test. They currently offer their subscribers access to 4,600 subscription titles and four Redbox DVD rentals for $8 a month. Customers can also digitally rent or buy around 4,000 movies for free to augment their subscriptions with new fare. Redbox Instant CEO Sean Strickland said that the beta test confirmed the company's belief that it was primarily catering to people who still value physical rentals. It's a Disc Plus offering, he said, with streaming supplemental DVD rentals. That approach is very different from Netflix, which also started out with movie-focused DVD service, but now invests heavily in TV content. So does that mean that Netflix and Redbox are going to be complementary as opposed to arch enemies?
No, they are completely competitors. They have been from the start, and they will remain so. It's as simple as that. Redbox is stepping into Netflix's space. Netflix is stepping into HBO's space. It's making its own content. One of the things in these articles about Redbox is that you know, independent new content from Redbox is really premature at this point. And why? Because it takes years to figure out what you need to do. In fact, we talk about House of Cards or the upcoming Arrested Development movie. They did, for lack of a better term, polling to figure out what would work. We've talked about House of Cards already and how, after seeing how people enjoyed the House of Cards series from England in the 1990s, and they enjoyed Kevin Spacey and David Fincher, they put that all together and said, Kevin Spacey, David Fincher, here's $100 million, do a House of Cards.
Right.
We're going to walk away because we just know it's going to work.
Right. We just gave you the recipe for success. Go do it.
Exactly. Exactly. Add any seasoning you want. Yeah. So you get that. And Redbox just isn't there yet. They don't have the kind of data. They don't have, like, you know, a pot to piss in when it comes to understanding the consumer as well as Netflix does. So they won't be able to get there.
Not at this point, yeah.
But what they are doing, it's just as Netflix is moving into HBO's territory, they're steadily moving into Netflix's territory. We all know the disc is going away. The disc is there, and I get it, and I think Redbox has a great model. You just kind of show up, you get your disc out, you go home, you watch it, you put it back. That's great, right? Mm-hmm. The thing about it is that there are people who are going to want both. They're going to have a Netflix account, and they're going to be going to Redbox. And now Redbox can actually track those people, aside from their credit card usage, you know, same credit card using the whatever. They can now track the people that are using their service in a way they couldn't before. And that data is going to allow them to expand their offering, to streamline their offering, and all those other things like that. But really what they're doing is they're saying, streaming is big. I have half the streaming stuff that the big guys have, Amazon and Netflix, and I'm going to see what I can do here. Luckily for them, they're already owned by Verizon, which has gobs of money. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. I've never actually used Redbox, so.
That's another thing that's interesting. They get the discs for new releases before Netflix gets them on streaming, obviously, right? So,
right.
And sometimes before Netflix gets them to mail out, because their deals are really nice. So
right.
They've got
Netflix
this hybrid
had those
thing.
Restrictions from major studios for
exactly.
Discs.
So
like
what?
30-day,
exactly.
15-day.
So, because what happens is they've got this situation where they don't want people just renting from Netflix flat out. You know, instead of pre-ordering the discs from Amazon or any other outlet that they can get the stuff from. You know what I mean, Andy?
Yeah.
So the Redbox, as a retail rental spot, that's just slightly less efficient. They got the stuff X amount of days out, where Netflix gets the stuff X amount of days plus Y amount of days out. So now Redbox has the same, you know, has this issue where their retail box stuff in the supermarket, wherever, gas station, that's going to get new titles. And the legacy titles are going to show up when they're streaming. And it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that. And whether the consumer is, you know, if I'm a consumer and there's enough and I'm into the new releases, then maybe I don't need Netflix. Maybe I can just do Redbox. I'll watch the older stuff on Redbox's online archive, and I'll get the newer stuff when it comes out in the Redbox. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Redbox also has the problem of space. In that kiosk,
right.
They can only have how many movies. But online, streaming, it's unlimited.
Right.
So the more deals they get for content, the more they can take the more popular movies from their kiosks, and they can get those to hang out online so people can continue to watch them. So there's a lot of good stuff here for Redbox. I think Verizon's doing a good job. I kind of wish they didn't rebrand it. They didn't have a separate brand. I wish it was just Verizon Movies. I think that'd be kind of cool.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it is what it is.
I think Redbox is a more it has a more prestige brand than Verizon when it comes to streaming movie delivery or movie delivery, I should say.
Yeah, I think you might be right. I just like the idea of the super uber conglomerate not being afraid of being a super uber conglomerate.
Sure. All right. Speaking of super uber conglomerates, let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, an Amazon company. The world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk about today is called A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson. I don't know anything about Bill Bryson, but apparently he's been an enormously popular author for both his travel books and for his books on the English language. And now this beloved comic genius turns his attention to science, and he has the uncanny ability to not say too much nor too little, to use metaphors brilliantly but without cliche, and to sound like he's actually learning as he goes along. Like Stephen Hawking before him, Bryson skips from one big topic to the next with the curiosity of a child and the patience of a schoolteacher. It's like having a front row seat to the history of the world. It sounded interesting, and I love science, and I love science told by people who are passionate about it. So this sounded like a good pick for this week.
Yeah, it sounds like I'm going to pick that up. I wonder if it's anything like the Mel Brooks movie.
Right, History of the World Part 1.
Exactly.
So to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 10,000-plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to check out their service. Even if you don't like the service and you want to quit Audible, you still get to keep that book for free. And going to that site, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, helps our show out. So please do that. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, is the end of Google Reader the end of RSS? Take a listen to this and come on back.
No!
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox. Speak, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down. High wire and a fire. Representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left to us are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down. My team reporters babble Trump, tethered crop, look at that, no plane, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population, common food, but it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, serve your own needs, listen to your heartbeat, dummy with the rapture and the reverend and the right, right, you patriotic, slam, fight, bright, light, feeling, pretty sight, it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas. Google has announced yet another spring cleaning of its various services, and this time around, the company is giving the axe to its Google Reader RSS aggregator. The service, which originally launched back in 2005, will be officially put out to pasture on July 1st, 2013. Reader has gone through a number of iterations, but it had not been significantly updated in a long time. The last time that Google updated the product, it built in integration for the Google Plus social network and removed Reader's own native sharing service, causing a bit of backlash with diehard users.
A bit of backlash? I know people who are not tech-focused at all, but Google Reader was their thing. The reason why was because it was an easy way. You go to Google, you put the website that you like in there, and it pulled the content from it. It would find the RSS feed and pull the content from it. I mean, if you're a person who is just kind of like not into like having to go and peck and hunt everywhere, but you like a certain niche, let's say music or whatever, that's a godsend. And Google's been not doing the best job of phasing it out by leveling expectations. I felt like Google Wave was phased out in a happier way than Google Reader was. And maybe that's because it was far less popular.
Because Google Wave was much reviled by everybody, I think.
I love Google Wave, dude.
Did you really?
I adored it, yeah.
What was there to love about it?
It is the only system I've seen that really does obviate the need for traditional email services. I think the idea that you can go back and forth in it without having the weird sort of like search is going to work sometimes functionality of Gmail is helpful.
But it was not user-friendly at all. No one could figure out – it wasn't intuitive. No one could figure out
– it was Evernote before Evernote was big. That's what it was. It was Evernote without the mobile app. It was an online version of Evernote. You could put something in there and then your friends could hop in there. And the thing about Wave that's so interesting is that they've taken the technologies from Wave and they've strewn them across all these Google products. They've put them in Google Docs, all the Google apps. The Google, you know, the chat functionality has been greatly improved by Wave. Mm-hmm. Wave was almost a testbed for so much of the stuff they wanted to do. It's just unfortunate that you know, when you look at that hour and a half or 2 hour presentation about what Wave could, you know, be and how it would replace your email, it seemed as real as it was. And I will add that when Google went through and they had that big presentation about Wave and how it was going to replace email and how awesome it was, I was someone sitting there with my eyes wide open, not unlike so many looking at Google Glass today. I'm hoping they've learned their lesson and that Google Glass will not become what Google Wave became, which is a pariah in technology.
We'll see, but I mean that's an interesting point. And Google Wave, you know, since that presentation, I've heard Google Glass derisively compared to the Segway. So we will see. It definitely has Segway potential of being this sort of superfluous, amazing technology. Google says it's killing off reader because the usage has declined, and they say, as a company, we're pouring all of our energy into fewer products. As one of the most popular RSS aggregators around, the death of Google Reader could spell doom for the RSS protocol itself, which has seen waning popularity since the rise of social sharing services.
So, yes, I mean, Twitter is huge. Yeah. I have, like, paper.ly, which uses Twitter in order to deliver you a significant amount of content, is one of these social sharing services that they're talking about. But there are alternatives. If you've been using Google Reader on the Reader app on iOS or OS X, that app is Google Reader proof, meaning when Google Reader dies, you can continue to put new websites into that app, and that app will be your RSS reader for that. You know, Tumblr still provides RSS feeds, and they're not going to stop. And Tumblr is a huge traffic source for content because the people are so specialized and so focused.
Let me ask you a question. Why is RSS still important in the era of bidirectional services like Facebook or Twitter?
Because it's not necessarily about what your friends are showing you. Sometimes it's just about what you want to follow. And having to follow that in the stream is cool, except for the fact that the stream is really ephemeral. I'm sitting there and I'm looking at Twitter, and if I don't see that post in the first hour and a half, I'm not going to see it ever. With my Google Reader, or even with Facebook, if someone puts something up that's, it could be funny, it could be like poignant, it could be whatever. Facebook is trying not to be Twitter. They're trying to find out a way to keep that post prescient to you if they think that it's relevant to you. And I think that I really appreciate that. But the RSS reader is an aggregator in the purest sense of the word. It's an ability to syndicate the content that you know you want to see and have it in one place so that you can deal with it. And it doesn't matter whether you're seeing it when it's posted, an hour after it's posted, or a week after it's posted. It's sitting there waiting for you in that box in a manner that is not as cumbersome as email. You can get an email with a link to it or whatever, but that's not the same. You want to invest in a source, and you want to, you know, travel up the stream. This article came out last week. I'm going to read the one that's right after that, and after that, and after that. You're on a plane or something, that's really wonderful. It's a Saturday morning, and you're just chilling. It's also catch up on the week's news. Doing that with Twitter's hottest stories seems cool, except for the fact that your friends may not be giving you the stories that you really care about. Like, it's great to say that we have a social situation. CNN made that whole social-focused news situation so that you see the stuff that's quote-unquote most important to you based on what your friends think. But the fact is, news and reading and periodicals, all that stuff, the best way to consume it for so many people is to just consume it without anyone curating it but yourself. And there's something to be said about the fact that when we're all looking at the same stuff, not because our friends told us to, but because it's good enough for us to look at, we are the society that we live in is better off because we all have the same frame of reference.
I'm going to read a quote here from Eric Goldman over at Forbes. He says, "People have been predicting the death of RSS for years, but the death of Google Reader moves us closer to RSS's demise than ever before. Without an obvious RSS reader alternative to Google Reader, and with heightened fears that any replacement RSS reader might also exit the market, just like Google and Bloglines, some folks will simply give up on RSS altogether and rely exclusively on social media, email alerts, and bookmarks. Others will use RSS less frequently because the alternative provider isn't as reliable or elegant as Google Reader. Collectively, with reduced reader demand, fewer publishers may support RSS feeds, creating the possibility of RSS's downward spiral. Some scholars have projected a dystopian future where internet users would create their own, quote, daily me of customized information sources, consuming only information that reinforced their existing beliefs rather than serendipitously being exposed to content that challenged or conflicted with their existing perceptions."
We are already there, Andy. Have you seen how people ingest the broadcast news? Fox, MSNBC, one's crazy right wing, one's crazy left wing. Like, the idea is that without RSS to just be kind of hanging out there and people to, like, Google Reader allowed you to share RSS, so there was some of that. But, you know, the idea that it's only curated by your friends, your entire news stream, it just reinforces this idea that however insular your way of life is, maybe you're somebody who's really open-minded, but you're never presented with the outlook of people who are less open-minded. So your tolerance for them drops in a way that that doesn't seek, you know, it's not healthy. It's not healthy because you're going to elect in this congressman who's hardcore against these different types of people, and then we end up with gridlock. You know, news and information like that is supposed to be able to help inform the electorate, and when unbiased information can't get to everybody because people don't may not agree with some aspect or premise of it, or their friends don't and they don't see it, they're not exposed to it, we end up with gridlock. And that's what the Fox Newses and MSNBCs of the world have done for years now.
So let me ask you, now that Google Reader is gone, what RSS readers should listeners use instead? And you already mentioned, what did you mention?
It's called Reader, R-E-E-D-E-R. Uh-huh. It's on iOS. It's on OS X. I think on the OS X and the iPhone, it's free. And if you get it for the iPad, it's like $5 or $6. That's the one that I use. I'm not crazy knowledgeable in what the other ones are that are around. But I do know that both Lifehacker and I believe VentureBeat have two separate articles on what to use now that RSS is dead. You know, not RSS. What to use now that Google Reader is down or is going to die. Reader, the one that I use, if you've been using it for Google, it's been, you know, you've given it permission to copy those feeds over. So it's not just reading from Google.
Yeah.
It'll handle things on its own. And when Google goes away, when it sunsets or winds down or however you want to call killing it, it'll still be there and you'll be able to use it. The other guys I think are the same way. So I would just Google like Google Reader alternatives. It's a lot of clickbait right now, so there should be a lot of stories on there as the smaller outlets try to get a little piece of the pie from that search term.
In a weird sort of twist, out of nowhere, Dig, the once mighty crowdsourced news aggregator that stumbled only to find new life as a curated collection of links, said that it would try and fill the void that'll be left once Google Reader disappears July 1st and leaves the world without a dominant RSS reader. Dig's Andrew McLaughlin said in a blog post, "We've heard people say RSS is a thing of the past, and perhaps in its current incarnation it is, but as daily users of Google Reader, we're convinced that it's a product worth saving, so we're going to give it our best shot. We've been planning to build a reader in the second half of 2013, one that, like Dig, makes the internet a more approachable and digestible place. After Google's announcement, we're moving the project to the top of our priority list. We're going to build a reader starting today." So I think that's, first of all, a terrific bit of,
publicity.
Publicity, taking advantage of Google's sunsetting of Reader. And good for them. Hopefully it'll work.
Maybe. I mean, on some level, it's like Dig's time is done as the top social.
But I think this is a great sort of pivot for them, you know?
It's an interesting pivot. And I'm saying that because Google is abandoning this, just like readers had abandoned Dig for Reddit. So, you know, Dig, I'm not trying to completely hate on Dig. But the fact is, there was a war. There's not many times when there's a straight up war in media. And there was a war and they really lost. And the fact that they're coming back to pick this functionality up, I mean, maybe AOL will pick it up too. Who knows? It's kind of interesting that they're chasing something that another company has discarded instead of trying to innovate in a brand new way.
One door closes, another door opens. Earlier today, Google launched Google Keep, a cloud-based note-taking service designed to help people keep track of their thoughts, scribbles, and notes. Google Keep draws some obvious similarities to Evernote, the popular note-taking app. With Keep, you can quickly jot ideas down when you think of them and even include checklists and photos to keep track of what's important to you. Your notes are safely stored in Google Drive and synced to all your devices so you can always have them at hand. Keep presents notes in either a list view or grid view and syncs them to the cloud. They're then accessible over the web and via an app. Although right now the Google Keep app is currently available on Android only. Did you check out this announcement?
I did. And you know what? I kind of feel like if you're going to have a notes app, just put it in the Google Drive app. Why has it got to be its own app? You have spreadsheets, you have docs, you have all that stuff in the Google Drive app. Mm-hmm. So let's just like keep that together. When it comes to what they're doing and how it affects Evernote, I feel as if Evernote, it hasn't stumbled, but it's constantly working to make itself maintain relevance by acquisitions, by new functionality, by use of the API. I think it's doing a good job. I'm a little disappointed in Google that this is yet another service that already exists in the marketplace that they're trying not to acquire or integrate with, but to replace with their own branded version of it.
Right.
It's a little strange. I don't think it brings Google up as a company. I see why they want to do it. Hey, look, everybody likes this stuff, and you know what? We can do it ourselves. But I feel like they're talking about as a company, they want to spend more resources on less products. And this is not
right.
You know, like this is not a product right. that they need to be a part of. Right. This is a solution. This is a problem for which there are a couple solutions.
Yeah.
And I get that, you know, they had the Google Notes inside of Gmail and things like that. I just don't see why they have to go and steal Evernote's lunch when they have so much to get right.
They have
so much to do.
On the one hand, I think that I can totally see why Google is doing this, because they're leveraging their brand to deliver an app that they hope that people who have already adopted all their other services will adopt. But on the other hand, I think you're right. They're getting away from their core competency.
And we've seen Apple do this, right? Like Instapaper is a wonderful solution for trying to figure out what you – oh, it's an article my friend sent it to me. It's the middle of the workday. I see it. I can't read it right now. Instapaper. Boom. I'll check it out later. Mm-hmm. Then Apple shows up with their offline reading list. And it's whack, right? It's clearly taking that functionality and just running with it. Saying, oh, we'll integrate this, and like, you know, maybe there's some hardcore diehard users of this particular service, but going forward, people will just use ours. And I get how that could be a plan for incremental success. What I don't see is how that innovates and makes you completely relevant in the marketplace. Yeah, get people into your ecosystem and lock them in there, but you know, business isn't about being honorable necessarily. And this is not a practice. Like I see the Google note taking, and I see like, you know, the Instagram, Instapaper rather, eating up from Apple, or the Instagram eating up from Twitter when they're trying to like, oh, you can add filters now and stuff like that. And it's just kind of like, you know, it doesn't make me excited to be a member or a user of these companies as much as I would be otherwise.
Okay, let's move on here. A big news here. Last week, Samsung unveiled the latest in its flagship Galaxy line, the S4. They packed a bigger 5-inch diagonal display into a package that's smaller than before. The Galaxy S4 is the same width, slightly shorter, and 7 millimeters thinner than its predecessor. The display is Super AMOLED 1080p. It uses a new 13-megapixel rear-facing camera with some new camera modes, including Eraser, which lets you remove unwanted people from a shot. Samsung says it comes in handy for shots that have been photobombed. It senses any motion that goes through the frame and lets you choose to remove it as if that person had never walked through that shot. It also has dual shot mode, which lets you use both the front-facing camera and rear-facing camera at the same time for both recording and still captures. One of the most useful new features of the Galaxy S4 is AirView, which lets you hover over something on the screen to get an extended pop-up view of what's inside. For example, if you hover over an email in your inbox, AirView...
With your finger. Your finger is hovering
over
the glass.
You don't touch the glass. AirView will bring up the first few sentences of the email's contents, or if you hover over an album within a photo gallery, you'll see 9 thumbnails of the contents of the gallery. Along with this, they've also added an air gesture feature, which lets you control the phone without having to hold it. You swipe left and right to switch between web pages, songs, photos, and the gallery, and swipe up and down to scroll, and even accept calls by waving at the phone. Also, they've incorporated their own translator, S-Translator, with 9 languages at launch date. Using the Galaxy S4's built-in pedometer, S-Health tracks your activity throughout the day and knows when you're running, walking, or climbing stairs. It also lets you input consumption activities to track caloric intake and get suggestions. Samsung didn't clarify exact pricing, but it said it would go for the same price as a, quote, Samsung premium smartphone. The Galaxy S3 launched in the U.S. at $199 with a 2-year contract. They didn't give a specific release date, but they did say it would be on store shelves in second quarter 2013. At AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint, Cricket, and U.S. Cellular. What did you think of this phone launch?
I mean, the announcement, not launched yet, but the announcement is a tight announcement. The device, you know, we'll see what it is when we get to it. But the device is a tight device. I mean, they've got functionality that I think is years ahead of some of their competitors. Like, where is HTC in this space? You know,
right.
the
right.
whole air gesture stuff. The ability to basically take Microsoft Kinect's relatively abstract functionality and incorporate it into your telephone. That's the device you're using all the time. That's tight. And yeah. I'm impressed. I really am. I'm also, what I'm more impressed about is Samsung and the other Android phones have been focusing on these bigger screens for a long time. And at some point people were like, well, when's it just going to become a tablet? And they've answered the question. They've said, we've got 5 inches. We haven't made the phone any bigger. And that's impressive. Right. That's really impressive. Apple made their phone longer. They took a different approach. And I think now that Samsung has been forced to design their stuff in a way that doesn't completely mimic their competition, Apple,
right.
They're becoming innovative as well as best they could. And I think they're doing a really good job. I think the universal translator aspect of this, and I'm going to call it that because I'm a Star Trek geek, mm-hmm. That is really exciting. The idea that I can basically, you know, chat in English to my phone and then have it spit out the Korean to my girlfriend's mother is really cool. That's like something that I've wanted for like years now. And the technology is there. Google has it. Samsung's leveraging it. The real question is, how easy is the phone to use? How easy is it to get from one of these services to the next? And I think that Samsung's had a pretty good track record of working with that. I'm excited not just for this phone and what it's going to do, because I'm seriously considering picking one up. I'm excited for what it's going to force Apple to do.
It's a good iOS point. 7. It's a really good point. It's already forced Apple to change its marketing a little bit. A couple days after the S4 launch, they launched a new web page offering subtly conveyed reasons why Android sucks and why the iPhone 5 is much better and you should buy it.
What is this website called? What is the URL?
It's called Why iPhone. I don't know how the exact. It's on Apple's site. It's a page on their site. It's a landing page called Why iPhone. And it goes through an extended list of reasons why the iPhone should be the only choice for the prospective phone buyer to consider. And it seems like an obvious sort of reaction to the Galaxy S4.
A couple of reactions to the Galaxy S4 from Apple, one of which was interviews by top Apple leadership on certain tech magazines. And what you see there is Apple, you know, reacting.
Right, which they usually don't. They usually,
this is a post Steve Jobs world. We're beginning to see that the 8-inch iPhone iPad Mini comes across as a reaction,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The notification center in iOS 5 came across as a reaction. You know, there are reactions, I guess in iOS 6 rather. There are reactions to what's going on in the mobile space. And Apple has to really figure out how they want to truly innovate. Siri was a reaction to Google Voice Search. It's gotten better, but it doesn't touch what's possible on the Galaxy Note, now Galaxy Note 2, or what Samsung's doing. Samsung also has this interesting situation. We all know that Samsung makes great phones, but the fact is they do make great TVs. They do make great computers and printers and things like that.
Right.
If they're smart enough to take their Galaxy devices and create a line across their varied projects so that AirPlay-like functionality begins to exist between a Samsung television, a Samsung phone and tablet, mm-hmm. and that AirPrint functionality shows up. I mean, they're not above doing that. We all know that. So the fact that Samsung is a vertically integrated company that makes every device under the sun, I really feel as if there's room for them to begin to, you know, eat into Apple's steam, and Apple has to react. They have to say that there's iPhone and then there's everything else, right?
Yeah.
That's really what they try to say. And the fact is there's not iPhone and everything else.
Right.
There's iPhone and then there's Samsung Galaxy and then there's everything else. Nexus right. doesn't even compare to the Galaxy phones right now. And Nexus used to be the flagship Android stuff. So
And to be honest, iPhone really hasn't made any sort of revolutionary advancements
in a long time.
No, we have data to show that, in fact, it hasn't. The iPhone 4S and the iPhone 5 can do every single thing exactly the same. Apple used to have barriers, software barriers,
right,
saying, oh, well, this phone won't be able to do this. The classic one is the iPhone 4S versus the iPhone 4. People got Siri working on the iPhone 4 through jailbreaking, but Apple wouldn't do it. They claimed that it was about the audio processing chip and how it wasn't really capable of doing it properly. The fact is, the phones could have handled it. And Apple, when they came out with the iPhone 5, the new form factor was enough of a change for Apple. But the actual software, there was no truly new capability, with the exception of, you know, a better camera and a larger screen, and the fact that it had to accommodate that. There was LTE. There were a couple things that were there in Android phones for a year or so, or 6 months or so already. And there wasn't really a key differentiator between the two devices, which is why the 4S continues to sell so well. You know?
Yeah. Speaking of these two companies chasing each other, Samsung is developing a wristwatch in its race to create an industry of new wearable devices that perform similar tasks to smartphones. We've been preparing the watch product for so long, Lee Hung Yi, executive VP of Samsung's mobile business, said during an interview. We're working very hard to get ready for it. We're preparing products for the future, and the watch is definitely one of them.
Samsung Health is a thing now, right? Like, yeah, they dropped them on the Galaxy S4. That's a big differentiator between the Galaxy S3 and the Galaxy S4. Yeah. I'm a Fitbit guy. I've become one.
Sure.
But I could see that, you know, why spend an extra $100 on a Fitbit device if you can Samsung your life away? And
right,
this is a new and emerging market. This isn't like how there's been Evernote for 6 years and then Google shows up with Evernote, right? This is a market that's just really changing.
It's wide open.
It's wide open. And it's I don't know. I'm impressed that they went there. And I know Apple and Nike and Plus have been together for a while. The Nike Fuel Band does not get good reviews. Nike Plus is not as advanced as what Fitbit's trying to do. So if Samsung can find some happy medium between the phone action and real data that's exportable and usable and visualized in a proper way.
But we're also talking about, in this respect, we're also talking about a Pebble clone and something similar to what Apple's rumored
iWatch might be.
Right. Right.
Exactly. So the thing about the Pebble is that it's not really an activity tracking watch. It can integrate with Runkeeper, but you need your phone on Bluetooth in order to do that. It doesn't actually track your movements, as far as I can tell, from what I've seen in their literature. Now, you know, they might be able to add the functionality. I know it does have an accelerometer or a gyroscope, but I haven't seen anything that says it records the data and then helps put it on your Runkeeper system, which is not Fitbit, 7 days worth of data without charging it or syncing it, and you'll be fine.
Sure.
So it's a different story.
Right. Okay, we're going to take another break here, listen to some music, and when we return, a Kickstarter campaign that proves there may be life after cancellation for your favorite TV shows. So take a listen to this and come on back.
A long time ago, we used to be friends, but I haven't thought of you lately.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini, and I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas.
Hey.
Veronica Mars is a cult TV show starring Kristen Bell as a young detective. It was canceled in 2007 after 3 seasons on UPN and its successor, The CW. But Veronica Mars wouldn't go away. It lived on the internet, in forums, in fan fiction, on YouTube, and especially on Twitter, where Marshmallows, diehard fans of the show, have been urging Kristen and company to reunite for years. Last Wednesday, show creator Rob Thomas mounted a Kickstarter campaign to bring Veronica Mars back to life, this time as a movie. The reaction so far has been overwhelming. Veronica Mars trended worldwide on Twitter, and the project quickly broke Kickstarter records, hitting its $2 million goal in less than 11 hours. It's currently, as we record this, at $3.7 million.
That's all money that would probably go into Kristen Bell's pocket because she's probably extremely expensive at this point. When she was doing Veronica Mars, you know, I'm sure if you gave her $200,000 an episode, she would have been happy. But, you know, that was 2004, 2007. It's now 2013, you know? She basically started this show 10 years ago. And given what she's been able to pull off with the Judd Apatow movies and other things like that, she's expensive. You know, and also she's aged considerably. I'm not saying she looks like an old woman. I'm just saying, you know, the high school that she was, that she played,
sure,
isn't really necessarily possible.
I'm
right
sure
now.
It would take place, you know, with the period of time elapsed taken into
exactly.
into
exactly. But let's look at what happened with the other show that everybody loved that became a movie, right?
Firefly,
2002, a single season. Everybody and their mother loved it, but Fox killed it by putting it on the Friday night slot, the death slot that Star Trek had.
Yes.
So,
as they have done with almost every other
Joss Whedon or sci-fi property. Yeah. So, you know, that show, it was out in 2002, right from 2002 to 2003. And, you know, it died. People loved it. And they brought it back in 2005 in the Serenity film. Now,
sure.
There's not a lot of time between 2003 and 2005. In fact, that's about as much time as it takes to film something and like, you know, do post-production on it. So that really could sit as a finale to a show, or really could sit as a way for fans to get closure, right?
Right.
We look at Arrested Development, another show that fans loved that got canceled in its third season, not unlike Veronica Mars. Netflix is bringing it back. They're going to have a little bit of a problem, you know, really bringing it back. But the fact is, the show was on far more recently than Veronica Mars. Its run was just more recent. So
it's an interesting point.
They're going to have a little less of a problem. I mean, we'll see what it looks like when it comes on, but there's going to be that. So I'm interested to see how they tackle the problem of, you know, Veronica Mars X amount of years later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think realistically speaking, when they say movie, what'll probably really happen is they'll four-wall a couple of theaters to legitimize its movie sort of status, and then and also some of the Kickstarter rewards included
screenings.
Yes, but it'll probably end up on direct-to-video.
It'll be a Netflix hit.
Right.
So that's interesting. It's just that it's kind of like, is that the way we want Veronica Mars to go down? Is that better than how it went down in the beginning? I mean, Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles would love to have a movie today.
Sure. Well, you know,
but it's not, Veronica Mars was far more esteemed than that show.
Paul Tassi at Forbes said Veronica Mars recognized they had a real shot of making this happen with Kickstarter. They correctly gauged the loyalty of their fan base, and it paid off for them. What's now going to surely happen is that many other people will now try something similar, but it's going to be hard to replicate this kind of success. I know that this is going to spark some sort of, quote, new media debate about crowdfunding and whether or not this changes the funding of films or not. It doesn't.
There's no debate here. People like the show. The network didn't. People want it. People will pay for it. No debate. It's capitalism.
He says, Veronica Mars had the perfect combination of a loyal fan base, a willing and available cast, and relatively low budget needs. Show me another series that has similar criteria, and we may indeed see this success replicated, but I can't imagine that there are many projects that would be able to reproduce these results.
My so-called life would have had the same exact situation if Kickstarter had been around a year after it went down in 1990, whatever.
Yes. But, you know, I really do think that this is a watershed event in the disintermediation of network TV. In an era where Nielsen ratings aren't always an accurate gauge of a show's viewership, especially online, it demonstrates that a show's cancellation doesn't have to mean its end if the fans are willing to put their money where their devotion is.
We've seen the devotion come back. Buffy the Vampire Slayer came back after five seasons.
Family Guy.
the guy who wrote Buffy the Vampire Slayer was actually done with Buffy.
Yeah.
But there were so many fans that were, you know, it ended well, 5 seasons. And there were so many fans who loved it that they brought it back via UPN, and he had to make 2 new seasons. The Family Guy, that was brought back.
Sure.
Futurama, that was brought back.
Exactly.
You know, with the animated shows, it talks directly to the points that the reporter brought in. It's got a loyal fan base. An animated show has a much lower budget than a live action show, and so on and so forth. I think Veronica, I'm excited that they're coming back with any kind of content, because I feel like they need to finish the show properly. And I feel like Kristen Bell, while she probably is far more expensive, she hasn't been able to grow in the way she could have if she had that show. Like, think about it. When you're a young woman in Hollywood, there are not many, there are lots of roles you'll be in, but most of them are sort of like young girl, girlfriend roles.
Right.
Like, let's just put it out there. Kristen Bell she was a detective, she was a teenager. She would have had to go through the Buffy transition of going to college if the show had lasted. And that would have been something, a show that allows the actor to really do a change. And I'm not saying that Kristen Bell is the most awesome actress in the world. I do like her work. But I think this gives her a shot to kind of like make her fan base that much more excited about her and to get some exposure so we can see a young millennial, you know, possibly like with some clout in Hollywood, beginning to, you know, choose the kinds of roles she wants and be the kind of woman that, you know, we've learned millennials to be, not just kind of the girlfriend, you know.
Now, there's a lot of cynicism online about Warner Brothers, about this being essentially a Kickstarter campaign of a Warner Brothers property, and how Warner Brothers has all this money, and how dare they, you know, how dare they lean on this sort of grassroots Kickstarter campaign to try and revive this series that they have that they clearly have enough money behind them to
do. They though,
to, well, you know what I was gonna say is that, I mean, Rob Thomas doesn't own this property. He had to get approval from Warner Brothers to initiate this campaign. So it's very possible that this may have all been an elaborate publicity scheme, but actually forking over hard cash sends a message to studios about an audience's interest in a show's revival in a way that emails and tweets, sort of grassroots campaign, you know, sending marshmallows to the studio, can't. And I think crowdfunding is the perfect medium for that message.
Andy, what we're seeing here is a confluence between the House of Cards situation, where Netflix has figured out that people want this and they can anticipate that, and the ability for people to give on things like Kickstarter. I'm not giving equity. I'm just giving I'm giving some stuff so that something can be made, and that's all I'm getting.
Right.
And if you're a network and you've got a risky property, because let's face it, it costs lots of money to put these shows on.
Yep.
And if you're a publicly traded company, you're not just going to put that money out there. Netflix has shown us that data is a good way to determine how to start something up. Veronica Mars is showing us that, you know, if you're a studio and you own a property and you know you want to get money out of it, you can turn to your shareholders and say, people really want this. They've already paid this much money.
Yep.
We can meet them halfway. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, we live in a world now with YouTube, you know, having its own you know, independent artists coming in and making new shows and things like that. Webisodes are a possibility for young startup artists. And you really have a place where people could very well, like, this has bigger implications in that.
Yep.
We may not need cable and the studios to provide our content for us.
This is what excites me so much about this announcement. Is that you? I mean, you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, it really is sort of this watershed event. And Rob Thomas commented on how Warner Brothers is handling this first test of a Kickstarter-funded studio project. He said, "Warner Brothers isn't treating Veronica Mars as like a one-off. I think they're treating us like a guinea pig in the best way. They want to see if this model works, and they made the calculated decision that we were a good test case for this. We just happened to be the right show at the right time, got to be the first one out the gate. I think Warner Brothers feels if this works, they could start doing more of these, and you know that if it works at one studio,
it's going to work at a lot of them.
They're not going to be the only studio in town that'll be trying it."
And this is a good thing for them to show. They can tell their advertisers, hey, look, we got people behind this. So do you want product placement in this film? Because we know that this many millions of people or this many thousands of people have gotten behind this show. We have an idea of their demographic. We have an idea of who they are and what they like. You know, we think your product would be good. And that gets Warner Brothers the kind of money that allows them to begin to take risks again. Remember, from the movie industry's, like, from the movie and television industry's outlook. They've been losing money on piracy and streaming because streaming doesn't have the same like cost as whatever. So they look at this and they're like, if I can get the public to pay for the series, to affirm, it's kind of like when I build a when I build a real estate property, if I can get people to buy half the units inside before I build it, then it's going to be a good, you know, I'm gonna be able to deliver.
It's a solid investment.
It's a solid worthwhile proposition. And you know, my whole thing is follow the money. There's no reason why we can't do that with media. We all want to live in a world where we don't have to necessarily pay the cable company to see a whole bunch of shows we don't care about. We'd rather, the polling is all shows.
Cut out the middleman.
Yeah, we'd rather spend more money on just the shows that we want. And Veronica Mars is going to be the masthead for that, then go, Rob Thomas.
It's interesting, since the Kickstarter broke its record goal, the show creators of Pushing Daisies, Chuck, and Terriers have all expressed interest in following Thomas's lead, and each of those shows individually have enough of a rabid fan base to make that happen for their shows.
Yeah, and I mean, what are we producing today on the networks, right? We've got The Big Bang Theory, which I'm not a fan of because I don't think it actually goes deep enough. We've got like Two and a Half Men, which is like painful to watch. Veronica Mars lost because it was like 30 Rock. It was a show with a small but dedicated following. And so they tried to be really smart. And sometimes when it comes to getting advertisers for that 18 to 34 demographic, that doesn't really work. If you can show that the people are willing to pay for it, then so be it. You know? And that's really what it comes down to. So this is an interesting model. We'll see how it turns out. But, you know, as a person who is an avowed capitalist, I can't think of a better way to revive an old TV show.
I'm in complete agreement with you. Now, I know, like, by this point, a lot of people are thinking about the obvious next property with a rabid fan base who'd actively crowdfund another revival without even blinking. We talked about it. Joss Whedon's Firefly.
Firefly, baby.
Before you get your
hopes up,
though.
People are old, though. That was a long time ago.
Well,
that
but I
ended before Veronica Mars started.
But Joss Whedon explained to BuzzFeed why this model won't, I mean, why this particular event won't lead to another Firefly movie anytime soon. He says that my feeling when I read about the campaign was kind of a dread, because I realized Firefly was the only thing that would be on everyone's mind right now. I've said repeatedly that I'd love to make another movie with these guys, and that remains the case. It also remains the case that I'm booked up by Marvel for the next 3 years, and I haven't been able to even get Dr. Horrible 2 off the ground because of that. So I don't even entertain the notion of doing this, and won't. A couple of years from now, when Nathan Fillion's no longer on Castle, and I'm no longer the Tom Hagen of the Marvel Universe and making a giant movie, we might look and see where the market is then. But right
let
now,
let me translate that for you. Yeah. A couple of years from now, when Nathan Fillion's out of work and I'm no longer taking in millions upon millions of dollars, maybe I'll consider going back to a property that launched my career. Maybe I'll do that. But right now, I've got money, people.
Yeah.
That's really what it comes down to. Yeah. And, you know, I've been a Joss Whedon fan since like the 90s. I'm completely in love with his work. When I say I'm a fan, I'm a fan. I'm a fanatic. I love all of his shit. So I can wait, because I know everything he's doing in the meantime is totally worth it. You know, I even like Dollhouse, which says a lot.
Me too. I actually like, I mean, yes. I would say after the first five episodes, Dollhouse got into this groove that it was just like it was humming on all cylinders. It took a little while.
Yeah.
All right, Dwayne DeFreitas, any other thing that you want to talk about before we sign off for the evening?
I think we got through it all. I think we talked about tech. We talked about web culture. We talked about all that stuff. I wish Tosin and Chris and DaVinci were here to talk with us, but they couldn't be. We'll talk to them next week.
Absolutely. All right. Well, in the meantime, where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, DwayneD. You can also go to flavors.me/DwayneD and kind of see my little blog and other shit that I'm up to. And that's the story.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, gplus.to/MrBabyMan for my Google Plus links, Facebook.com, Twitter.com/MrBabyMan. As far as The Drill Down goes, check out our past episodes on, as well as all the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. If you want to subscribe to us, go to iTunes and do a search for The Drill Down, or go to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar there. Our show is on Stitcher, so you can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Go to Stitcher.com. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about, or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let our podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. We'll be joined by Tosin once again, and he'll give us updates on PAX. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. A long time ago, we used to be